This is Fresh Air. In his 40-year career, Richard Fleischer has directed movies in many genres. Action, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Historical epic, The Vikings. Biblical epic, Barabbas. Film noir, The Narrow Margin. Films for kids, Dr. Dolittle and Fantastic Voyage. War film, Tora, Tora, Tora. Sequels, Conan the Destroyer and Amityville 3. And remake, The Jazz Singer. All that plus Mandingo. Fleischer has just written a memoir about his film career called Just Tell Me When to Cry. Fleischer got one of the biggest breaks of his career when Walt Disney asked him to direct the now classic 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. Talk about irony. Disney was very unpopular in the Fleischer household when Richard was growing up. His father was Max Fleischer, the great animator who gave us Betty Boop and Popeye. Max Fleischer and Walt Disney were competitors for years.
My father had a running kind of feud with Walt because my father was an early pioneer in animation. He was a wonderful animator. He started his own series in about 1914, long before Walt Disney appeared on the scene. And my father became a big international personality because of the Out of the Inkwell cartoons that he originated. And then Disney came along quite a few years later and started out by imitating my father. And from then on, it was a race between the two animators to see who could become the most popular. And Disney always seemed to be one step ahead through no fault of my father's, but that's the way things worked out.
So what was your first meeting with Walt Disney like? Did you feel like a traitor?
I got a call to come up to see Walt Disney, and it was as mysterious as that. There was no reason given as to why Walt Disney wanted to see me. I couldn't imagine why. I went up to see him, and he presented me with the offer to direct 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and I was really bowled over when I had this offer, and I said, do you know who I am? And he laughed, and the others that were in the room laughed, and they said, yes, we do know who you are. We'd like you to direct this picture. And I asked him why, knowing the background of this whole thing, and he made a little joke of it. He said, well, I saw the picture you made, The Happy Time, that had starred Bobby Driscoll. And then I remembered that Bobby Driscoll was a child actor that worked in some of the Disney pictures. And Walt said, anybody who can make an actor out of Bobby Driscoll, it's got to be a wonderful director. So I had to acknowledge he was right. And that's how I got the job. However, I made a proviso. I said, I'd love to do this picture, but I really feel I should clear it with my father. I wouldn't want him to think that in some way I was being disloyal to him. So he said, fine, I understand that. You do that. My father at that time was living in New York, and this happened in California. So he said, you call your dad tonight and get back to me tomorrow morning. Tell me whether you want to do the picture. So I called my father that night and told him the problem. And he said, well, by all means, you must do that film. You didn't even have to call me, and naturally you must do that. He said, it's a great opportunity for you. So I was much relieved, and I went with a clear conscience to work with Walt Disney.
So meanwhile, you made 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. You, somebody who got seasick very easily.
Yes.
You spent a lot of the time sick while you were making the movie?
I threw up a lot, yes. I was never a good sailor. I never liked the water, in fact. But I learned to aqualung. I even learned to throw up in an aqualung, which is a neat trick.
Not such
a neat trick. But I eventually got used to it, and I spent more time underwater than anyone else on the picture, including the stuntmen.
Any rough spots you got in underwater?
Well, yes. We had one shark situation, which was very tricky. The scene called for a shark to attack some of the stuntmen who were who were pretending to be the real actors. So we got a 8-foot shark and killed it. And it's very difficult to kill a shark. It's not an easy thing to do. And we got all kinds of advice on how to kill the shark, which is mainly to bang it on the head with a hammer and then leave it out in the sun for 24 hours. And that should do the trick. So we did that. And then we wired up the shark and aimed it so that we could pull it down a wire right at our actors. And of course, while we pulled it, the shark revived and started swimming around and breaking all the wires that attached to it and making passes at the actors. That everybody scrambled. Of course, the dangerous part, the most dangerous part, was the fact that the cameraman was riding on the back of the shark, and he had the camera tied onto the shark with a rope that had a slip knot, so that in case something did happen, he could pull the slip knot, and release the camera. Well, when the shark broke loose and revived, the cameraman pulled on the rope, but the knot would not release. And he was determined not to let go of that camera and lose the camera and all the film that we'd already shot for that sequence. So we just hung on, pulling on that rope, and then disappeared off into the deep blue. We lost sight of him, and we were scared to death. I was awfully worried. And the lifeguards took out after him, and a little while later, I saw them swimming back with him, holding him up under his arms. And the rope eventually came loose, but not before the shark had dived toward the bottom and the cameraman broke both his eardrums.
Wow. Oh, gosh.
So it was not a pleasant experience.
Was he off the movie after that?
Actually not. He recovered. He spent a few days in the hospital and came back and worked. So it wasn't too bad.
Film director Richard Fleischer is my guest. He's written a new book called Just Tell Me When to Cry. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is film director Richard Fleischer. 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea won an Oscar for Best Special Effects. But the first footage that you shot with the fake giant squid apparently looked really bad, and you had to reshoot it. What was the problem the first time around?
Well, it was what you could call a disaster, because the squid that had been built for the sequence didn't work. It was very primitive, and it would do hardly anything at all. It was manipulated by wires, but it was filled with kapok.
What is kapok?
Kapok is a spongy material that, they use it in stuffing mattresses and
sometimes life preservers. Does it look more like a Muppet or something?
Yeah, but it's acted more like a sponge, and it was sopping up water. And, of course, this thing was sopping up water, and the squid was getting heavier and heavier, and of course it broke the wire, so we were constantly having to stop and rewire. And then the material that the squid was made out of didn't seem to hold up underwater with water on it, and pieces would fall off or tentacles would fall off, and it was like a Keystone comedy. And I had all these stuntmen out there wrestling with this lump piece of, I don't know what, liver, and trying to make it look real, and of course it didn't work. And finally Walt Disney came down on the set after he'd seen some dailies and film, and he said, we've got a big problem here. What you're shooting is a joke. Now, why don't you quit this sequence? Go start something else in the picture, some dramatic scenes, and let me consult with the geniuses that I've got working at Disneyland and see if we can't come up with something better than what you have to work with now. So I happily agreed with that. Believe me, I was delighted to get off of that sequence for the moment. But several weeks later, they did come up with a wonderful squid that was now completely automated with lots of electronics in it and hydraulics, and it had a beak that snapped and moved in and out and eyes that opened and closed. And it was operated by people above it with wires. We had about 40 people operating that thing, puppeteers. But it worked. It worked very, very well. And that's how we got that sequence made.
One of the movies that you directed, you were basically asked to fix. The movie had been in production. A lot of it had been shot, but it wasn't working. I'm thinking of the remake of The Jazz Singer that starred Neil Diamond and Laurence Olivier as his father.
Yeah.
So you were called in to fix it. And one of the things that was a real problem in the movie was Olivier's performance. You thought he was really overacting.
Yeah.
So how do you tell Laurence Olivier that he's overacting?
Well, you had to find... I didn't want to lie to Larry Olivier, but I had to find another truth to tell him. Some things I just couldn't change. It was too late to change. Things like his accent that he was doing, a kind of a Jewish accent, which I didn't think was good at all. But he was enamored of it. And since I didn't have time too much time to work with him because his contract was about to expire and he was getting $1 million for the picture. I had to find ways to, when I was, and I redid all of his scenes, every one of his scenes I had to redo because he was way overboard and I just had to bring him down, that's all.
Toward the end of Olivier's career, a lot of people really wondered why was he taking roles in movies that you knew weren't going to be very good when he was such a great actor. He wrote a letter to you after the making of The Jazz Singer, trying to explain why he was even in the movie. What did he say in that letter?
Well, it was a wonderful letter. And he said, you know, there's nothing really wrong with doing something for money. It doesn't always have to be the highest artistic aims, but why not? There's nothing wrong with commercialism. But the real thing, the kernel of what he was saying, the truth of what he was saying, was in that letter when he said, I am concerned about leaving behind me sufficient financial stability from my beloved ones, my beloveds, as he said in his letter. And that was really, I think, the basis of why he did all of these films. So you have to realize, first of all, that although Laurence Olivier was probably the greatest actor and one of the, certainly the most famous actor who ever lived, he was not a highly paid actor for most of his career. Most of his career he worked in England. And in England, they do not pay actors the way we pay them here. So he never made a lot of money. And it wasn't until he, in his later years, when he started making films in this country, that he began to make some money. And by that time, he had many illnesses. All of them seemed to be life-threatening illnesses. And he was awfully worried about dying and leaving his family without any support.
Right, right. Can I get back to ask you a couple more things about your father?
Sure.
I'm really wondering what it was like to grow up in a house where your father was making these extraordinary cartoons, Betty Boop cartoons, Popeye cartoons.
It was heaven. It was sheer heaven. I grew up in this kind of fantasy world. When I was a kid, my best friends were Coco the Clown and Betty Boop and Popeye and... I was born and brought up in those surroundings. And I spent a lot of time at my father's studios in New York and got to know the artists, and they were always over at the house. We had a wonderful time. My father was a great man and a wonderful human being, and he was terribly funny. So it was wonderful. He couldn't be a better father. And it was great fun being in our household, I must say.
I think it was after the Comic Code came into effect that your father had to clean up Betty Boop and make her less the sexy vamp and more the housewife. How did he react to that?
Well, everybody was very unhappy because you know, Betty Boop, the whole attraction of Betty Boop is her sex appeal, and it's a kind of an innocent sex appeal. She's very sexy, but very innocent. And, of course, that caused great consternation at the Hays office, which was the industry censorship office at that time, wanted to... Betty Boop always wore kind of mini skirts, mm-hmm. which was way daring for that period, and she wore a garter on her left leg. So they objected to the garter, had to take the garter off, objected to the length of the skirt, had to lower the skirt. Then she wore very low-cut gowns, and low-cut dresses, so they had to raise the neckline. And she became kind of a school marm and really hurt the character. And they eventually... although it did damage the character because of this new and bad look, this Quaker look, they there was a great public demand to go back to the old Betty Boop. And so my father defied the Hays office and went back to the old style. And there was no big problem about doing that.
Richard Fleischer's new memoir is called Just Tell Me When to Cry. He's now producing a Betty Boop feature film. This is Fresh Air.